Welcome back to our CRESPED series of talk media events. I'm Dr. Emma Morton, and I'd like to warmly welcome you to today's session. I'm speaking to you from Vancouver, British Columbia, the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. And wherever you are joining us from today, thank you for being with us. The start of a new year is an ideal time for us to discuss today's topic, which is self-compassion. January is a time where we're surrounded by media messages about setting goals, and I'm already starting to see media pieces questioning how long until people who made fitness-related goals for New Year's will start cancelling gym memberships. And unfortunately, these kind of stories convey the attitude that behaviour changes are all or nothing, which can reinforce perfectionistic, self-critical beliefs. And of particular concern for people living with bipolar disorder, these kinds of unrelenting standards can trigger mood changes, which our panelists will talk more about today. A potential antidote to perfectionism and self-criticism may be self-compassion. And if you've ever attended a TalkBD event, you will likely have heard the hosts, including myself, talking about the importance of self-compassion when it comes to implementing any new self-management strategy. However, trying to become more self-compassionate can be easier said than done. So today our guests are going to be talking more about the importance of self-compassion for people living with bipolar disorder and give you some practical strategies to try to bring a little bit of more of self-compassion into your daily life. So I'd like to welcome our guest speakers for today's session, Dr. Thomas Richardson, a clinical psychologist and associate professor at the University of Southampton, who has previously joined us for the TalkBD episodes on gambling and money. We are also joined by Cara Lissette, a mental health advocate, author, and therapist. Thank you both for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to hearing your insights about this important topic. But before we do, I'd like to start with some quick introductions and a little bit of housekeeping. So I'm a researcher at the University of British Columbia working with the CRESPED team to build and evaluate a new self-management app to help people with bipolar disorder optimize their quality of life. I'm really passionate about the ability of digital tools, including things like this webinar, to help support people in their self-management practices. Here at CRESPED, we like to practice what we preach about the importance of work-life balance. So I'll also be sharing and asking our guests to share one non-work related thing that they do with their time. So given that this is our first episode of the new year, one particular hobby that I'd like to try out in 2023 is cross-stitch. I find that crafty activities and doing things with my hands helps calm my busy brain. But I am running out of wardrobe space for crocheted jumpers, so it is the time to try something new. I'll now pass the mic to Dr. Richardson to introduce himself. We'd love to hear more about where you work and one non-work thing that you do in your downtime.
Hello, yeah, Thomas Richardson. So I live in Southampton in UK, South Coast, and I train therapists to do therapy for bipolar disorder, and I have various research projects, some of which are related to this topic here. I have lived experience of bipolar disorder myself as well. What I do with my spare time, let me unblur myself quickly. There are some drums. I do play the drums. I've been playing the drums since I was growing up, but I took the plunge this year trying to be kinder to myself and give myself more me time. And I actually reached out and asked for a drum lesson. And I've started playing with people for the first time in a long time as well. So yeah. Music, love music.
That's very exciting. I think I've mentioned this before, but we will very soon have a full CRESPED band. Yourself and Greg Murray can have a drum off.
Excellent. Is he into heavy music or?
Jazz, I think, but
jazz, all right, jazz, I could do jazz, yeah.
Cara, as a first time TalkBD guest, I'm very keen to know more about you. So same question, what do you do for work and what do you do for yourself in your downtime?
I'm Cara. I am a children's therapist specializing in working with people under 18 experiencing low mood and anxiety disorders. I'm also a mental health nurse by background before I went and trained as a therapist. And I've always worked with children through sort of my whole mental health career. I'm also an author, and I've written a couple of self-help books for people with eating disorders and one for bipolar disorder, and I've got a couple more coming out for OCD and anxiety over the next couple of years. And I just do a lot of like advocacy work around mental health, so specifically focusing on eating disorders and bipolar disorder, which are the two things that I've got lived experience with. And in my spare time, I do a lot of horse riding, and I also do quite a lot of cross-stitch.
Oh, very cool. I'd love to see some of your projects. And of course, network lead Erin Mihalik would be very excited to hear about the horse riding. So thank you both for sharing a little bit more about yourselves. We also have our behind the scenes helpers, Caden and Bryn, who will be managing the chat and our Facebook page. So today we do have people joining us via the Zoom meeting, but also streaming live over YouTube. So if you do have questions, please pop them into the Zoom Q&A box or YouTube comment or anonymously via the Crest BD Talk BD page, and we'll get to them after the main presentation. But for now, I'll hand it over to Tom and Cara to tell us more about why self-compassion is so important and what we can do about it.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for having me, everyone. So I think the main sort of 3 points we're going to get across is, I guess, showing about high standards and perfectionism in bipolar disorder. And then I just want to say a little bit about where self-compassion fits in and how that might kind of try and be a counteract to some of the mood changes that Emma said can come with those kind of high standards, and a little bit more about what you can do about that. So there's quite clear research that people with bipolar tend to have quite high levels of what's called dysfunctional assumptions. So these are kind of quite deep beliefs that you've probably had for a while about kind of achievement and about goal attainment. Like, I need to do really well, and I need to achieve in order to sort of, you know, do something meaningful. There, so in depression as well, people who have depression but not the mania, they tend to be the same, the kind of the same level of these dysfunctional assumptions. Now, there's a bit of a sort of chicken and egg thing that comes with a lot of these discussions about which comes first. Does it actually lead to mood changes? It potentially does, but what we do know is that these beliefs are kind of especially strong. They kind of really come out of the woodwork if you're feeling depressed. You might really kind of, these beliefs really kind of ramp up. So I'll just read a couple of questions from some of the measures we've used in research. Just think if this, what you'd answer this. So like, if I fail partly, it's as bad as being a complete failure. My life is wasted unless I'm a success. And yeah, there's, when I read those questions, there's part of me where it kind of pulls a little bit on somewhere deep inside me where I'm like, I know that's not true, but there's part of me that wants to go, yes, that's true. Cara, I don't know if there's anything you want to just add.
No, I definitely relate to that. And something that I think I've really struggled with is almost feeling like I have to overachieve to make up for the fact that I've got a mental health problem. So thinking that, you know, if people might think badly of it, or I might, you know, if I'm like depressed, might not be doing things as well as I would like to be doing them. Feeling like I've almost got to overcompensate for having, you know, something quote unquote wrong with me. So needing to overcompensate by being really, really good at lots of other stuff to kind of make up for the fact that I feel like there's things that I'm not so good at, even though I know that they're not my fault. It's because that I've got an illness and there's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And I've certainly worked with a lot of people who can, you know, this, where the self-compassion comes in, can be very, very hard on themselves because, you know, maybe, yeah, they've had time, they're not able to work, or they've had to have time off work, or the kind of things that do happen when you are unwell and that have come with that. So yeah, I can understand that maybe that comes a bit like I've got to make the most of it, certainly. So yeah, these kind of dysfunctional assumptions, and also perfectionism, which is overlapping. So the kind of, there's these high standards, like I really need to achieve. There's this overlapping concept of perfectionism, which we know is generally quite high in a lot of mental health problems, such as depression and anxiety and eating disorders as well. It's kind of quite strongly linked with anorexia nervosa. But it also tends to be quite high in bipolar disorder, and it tends to be linked to kind of high levels of anxiety. So again, I'll just read out a couple of questions. I rarely live up to my high standards. I expect the best from myself. You know, so it's more kind of like I have to really achieve and do the best. So I think research shows people with bipolar tend to have these high standards and can have quite sort of catastrophic thoughts about failure, like very, very hard on themselves when things go wrong. I'm not sure if, Cara, that's your kind of experience.
Yeah, absolutely. If anything goes wrong, even if it's smaller, I could get like, I don't know, 98% on a test, but if I haven't got 100%, then I feel like I might as well have just failed it. But it does feel really, really catastrophic. And I have got better over the years of trying to rationalize that with a lot of therapy has kind of got me to that point. But I think it's a really, really difficult mindset to get out of if it's something that you're really kind of set in or have been doing for a really long time.
Yeah, I think it's there for a while. It's there from when you're quite young. And I as a psychologist, I'd kind of view, you know, being quite hard on yourself, these high standards, as kind of a bit of a risk factor, really, you know, and certainly, yeah, absolutely a target for therapy, something that you want to try and work on. There's an overlap as well with self-esteem, you know, which tends to be, as you probably know, a bit up and down in bipolar disorder. So this is self-esteem is how confident you feel in terms of that you can, you know, get things done and do things well. As you probably know, you know, when you're depressed, that tends to be quite low. You feel like you can't really get much done. And then if you're kind of hypomanic manic, it can go to the extreme end where you feel very overly confident and overly optimistic. So it can go up and down. So there is research that people with bipolar, if you compare to people who don't have it, tend to have these kind of quite, they can be quite hard on themselves. So quite low levels of self-compassion. And, you know, certainly this has increased in the last few years. There's quite a lot of research about how this low self-compassion can be a problem in a lot of mental health problems. But we know it's there for bipolar disorder. And I think as Cara was saying a little bit there, it can work both ways, I think, in terms of how it relates to your mood, these high standards and this self-compassion. So, you know, as you all know and would have experienced, when you're kind of hypomanic manic, you tend to have lots of drive and lots of, you know, goal focused activity, doing more, taking on more, spending more. And, you know, the high standards can be part of that. The high standards can be part of that because it's like, kind of like Cara was saying, you know, I've got to make the most of it. I've got to make up for lost time. You know, if you're depressed and you haven't been maybe as productive and then you may be going manic, it's kind of quite easy to go, well, I can kind of use this, I can achieve, I can be really productive. So it can drive that mania, you know. And I think a lot of people do experience the mania can be around achievement. It might be around something creative, it might be around, you know, excessively working really long hours, or it might be about, you know, setting up a new sort of a grand business scheme. So those kind of high standards can definitely fuel the mania, I think. Cara, over to you for any thoughts there.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's really difficult about it, because there's a sort of level of mania before it gets really destructive, in which a lot of people are actually just really productive and creative and all those sort of things. And like, I personally have done some things that have been really successful when I've been manic, and actually it's really difficult to then think, oh, I want to stop myself from being in that position again, when you know you've achieved some really good things when you've been in that kind of state previously. But obviously you can't control where that stops when it happens, which is sort of the difficult thing about it. But I think it's really difficult when you are someone who's quite achievement driven to stop yourself from doing something that can sometimes give you really positive achievements, and you could get really good, you know, feedback from the things that you're doing from the people around you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important point. I think that's part of why the mania can be, I'll use the term sort of tempting, you know, to go with it. And I get that, because I there's part of me that feels like I can be, you know, really productive if I'm just a little bit manic. But it's a risky game, like you said, Cara, isn't it? Because you can go too far. It's very hard to kind of you can't stop it. You know, I've used the metaphor before of being on a skateboard going on a steep hill. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't get off soon, it's going to go fast and out of control. So I think that is where self-compassion and being kind to yourself does come in. Giving yourself permission to put the brakes on a bit. I think we all need that with bipolar, because, you know, if, you know, I've certainly experienced it where maybe I'm noticing some early warning signs and I really need to, you know, a really important part for me of staying well is just doing less, you know, like, right, I've got to prioritize. I don't, you know, what work can I leave and that kind of thing. But that the high standards in me is like, no, you can't stop now. And so actually just giving yourself permission to just put the brake on, you know, maybe you need to take some time off sick if you're working. Maybe you can shut the computer, turn off the phone, is actually really important. Because, yeah, you know, there's truth that maybe when you're a bit manic, you might get a lot done, but it's a risky game, isn't it?
My therapist always used to say, it's you always want to be Superman, but it's okay to just be Clark Kent sometimes.
Yeah.
which is a good lesson for me.
Yeah, I like that. And then, I get it, it's from my own therapy. I've really worked on that. But I remember when I was, I felt like a hypocrite. I was teaching people how to do therapy with bipolar disorder. And I had a big, on my slideshow, I had a big like picture saying it's okay to be average. And I kind of remember in the middle of a lecture looking at it and just going, no, it's not. You know, it's not okay to be average. So part of the therapy was definitely for me trying to be kinder with that. So it can lead to the mania, but I think also these high standards, it, you know, it definitely links to the low mood and the depression as well, because, you know, if you have very high standards and you're very perfectionist, you know, it can work both ways, because, you know, we know, for example, that it's not just negative life events in bipolar that can trigger relapses, positive life events. And I think these high standards is part of that, because, you know, you get a promotion, but that's not enough. Right, what next? I've got to keep going. So it can lead to mania. But then if you also have very high standards and very high goals for yourself, you know, if something doesn't go right, because life happens, you can be very hard on yourself, very, very self-critical. And I think you could probably all see how that can relate to depression. And you might start to say, oh, what's the point? I'm useless. And, you know, shut yourself away and kind of spiral down. Do you have any thoughts, Carol, on how it maybe relates to the depression side, these kind of high standards and compassion?
It's just like a really vicious cycle, I think, because you're, you know, if you're not, you know, perhaps achieving whatever it is that you're kind of aiming for, that can cause, you know, you to feel depressed. But when you're depressed, you're also just less likely to be productive and be able to achieve the things that you want to. So I think it's just really difficult to just get stuck in a really negative cycle of feeling like you're just not able to achieve things and then feeling really down on yourself because you're not achieving things. And that makes it then really difficult to sort of pull yourself out of that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Vicious cycle is unfortunately the right word, I think. And, you know, sometimes the depression that comes, maybe because sometimes people can become manic for, you know, a while and then actually crash. And I think, again, that part of that can be the really self-critical tendencies coming out because of the difficult stuff that can happen when you're manic, the stuff you do that's completely not the usual you, because you're unwell, because you're very impulsive, you know, such as, you know, I've done research, you know, Emma said, I've spoken before about money, and a theme that came out was the kind of the guilt and shame people feel after an impulse spending binge. And yeah, the other kind of things people do, like, you know, making jokes that they wouldn't usual, or, you know, risky sex, that kind of thing that isn't usually what they do. There could be a lot of shame that comes with that, and really sort of self-critical tendencies. So I do think, you know, that vicious cycle can be people really being hard on themselves and sort of hiding themselves away, you know, from what happens when you're manic, you know, picking up the pieces. So I think trying to be a little bit kinder to yourself after you've had you know, been really unwell is just really important to help you get back on track. You know, it's not your fault. You're really unwell. I think anyone like this community here who has bipolar disorder, if they'd known what you did when you were manic, they don't, you know, they'd understand, right? Yeah. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I would agree. I think almost worse for me then the things that happen when I have a manic episode is like the depression that comes afterwards. And that, I don't think that's just chemical. I think some of it is just like the feelings of like the shame and the guilt that come after something like that, and like the disappointment, like feeling really disappointed in myself. And that's something that I've really struggled with, is thinking, you know, I do everything right in terms of what I need to do to look after my mental health, and yet things like that still happen, because that's just the nature of the illness. And I think that's something that I really struggle with, is just that no matter how much I try to control what's going on in my life, that I can't always, and that is a sort of big indicator for a big crash for me afterwards. Yeah. Is the feelings that come afterwards.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's very important for, you know, to be kind to yourself, about all of us, about, you know, yeah, I'm doing everything I can. And you're right, you know, I'm gonna get unwell sometimes, and you know, we all make mistakes, that's okay. I think that's really important to bear in mind, and just give yourself permission to kind of move forward and pick up the pieces. Mm-hmm. And take time off work. You know, it does take time to kind of recover, but I think it's really important. Something I always say to my, you know, my patients is just like, what would you say to someone else? Because mm-hmm. I think we're all very good at, you know, giving advice to others, you know, being kind to others, and maybe not quite so good at taking that advice on board ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I think that's quite a powerful thing, potentially, if you're like, well, you know, if I had a friend who had bipolar disorder, what would I say, you know, if they told me that, you know, they spent all the rent money, or they'd had an affair, or, you know, something like that, what would you say to them? So in terms of kind of the evidence, there's a few trials that have looked at whether therapy, in particular CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, but also mindfulness might improve these dysfunctional assumptions, like the very high standards. So it's kind of, I always think that, like, when I'm doing therapy, you know, when you're working at that, there's something about going deeper, like at the kind of a surface level relapse prevention work, you're thinking about, you know, triggers and early warning signs and coping strategies. And that's really, really important. And I think there's something about digging a little bit deeper to those kind of beliefs and those perfectionist and those self-critical tendencies, you know, because often actually, if you dig deep, sometimes people have a bit of a belief that, you know, I need to be hard on myself to get the best out of myself. Like, I need, you know, if I'm hard on myself, other people won't be hard on me. Or if I criticize myself, I won't make mistakes. You know, I'm not sure if that chimes with your experiences, Cara, or people you've worked with.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I am a CBT therapist, like, by background. So I'm a massive advocate for CBT. I think it's brilliant. And I think we don't use it enough with people with bipolar disorder at all. I think therapy is really underutilized, and that actually, you know, the default is medication, and people just kind of get left to it, when actually we know that the combination of both those things is much more effective than one or the other on their own. But I would definitely agree with that. And also, you know, something that I had a lot of difficulties with is thinking that other people would only value me if I was achieving things, so that if I wasn't doing that, then I was just, you know, I just didn't really like matter to people. And that was like a really big driver for that sort of perfectionistic stuff as well. So it wasn't just, it was all internal, obviously, but it was my perception of what other people thought about my achievements, as well as what I thought about my own achievements.
Yeah, thank you. And there's you know, our own standards for ourselves, and then a lot of it is how we worry about how other people see us. And I think that might be a good thing to ask someone to test that, you know, do you care as much as I think you do? Because often we really worry about what people will think of us, but maybe we didn't worry, you know. I've got to be really aware of this, to be honest, working in academia, because academia is very competitive, and it's very easy to compare yourself to others, because you get like a number to work out, you know, what kind of a researcher you are. This is how many papers you've published. So I really have to watch, because it's very easy to compare yourself to others, and you know, imposter syndrome. So yeah, I think it's very important just to, I think that's part of it, isn't it? Not comparing yourself to others. It's not always helpful. So yeah, there's a type of therapy called compassion-focused therapy, which was kind of pioneered here in the UK, actually, by a psychologist called Paul Gilbert, and he was working with people with very kind of quite entrenched depression, and he was using CBT, and you know, CBT really works for depression, but he found that for some people, you know, you can't kind of do this, like, you know, challenge a thought as right or wrong that I'm not good enough, because people might know at an intellectual, rational level that they're a good person, but there's just a very deep sense of shame. And, you know, we do know, unfortunately, that actually people with bipolar disorder are 4 times more likely to have experienced emotional abuse when they were growing up. So there's often a trauma element to it, where that comes from, bullying, you know, for example. And so the compassion-focused therapy is trying to get in touch with a more self-soothing. So it's at a more emotional, kind of deeper level, trying to self-soothe and be a little bit kinder to yourself. And there aren't any trials for bipolar disorder published yet, but I think there is one ongoing in the UK. But we certainly know it can be helpful with depression, and we know that it can be helpful with other problems such as anxiety and such as psychosis as well, actually. Cara, I'm not sure if you've got any experience of using sort of elements of compassion-focused therapy. Or...
Do you know what? I haven't, but I think it sounds like it would be really effective for people who, you know, like you said, like CBT doesn't work for everybody. And you're right, there are people who intellectually can understand, you know, where you're doing things like thought challenging continuums and things like that. People, they don't always work, because people are rationally able to say, even though I feel like a bad person, I know that I'm actually not a bad person. So sometimes it's not about targeting the cognition itself, is it, but more about targeting the feeling that kind of comes along with that.
Yeah, and I think for me, there are times where I, even though I might know I'm doing okay, I can be quite hard on myself. And I think sometimes to the more kind of quite deep and more kind of often meditation type exercises. We've put quite a few links in the resources of when I was working in a mental health team, a few recordings of some compassionate exercises. So there's one which is like imagining a really safe, calming place. You know, for like a lot of people, it's on a beach or in a woods. Sometimes it can be helpful to think about like a memory of a time you felt really cared for. An exercise I sometimes use with patients is something called perfect nurturer. And this is actually trying to sort of close your eyes and visualize, you know, what would someone who really understands you and cares about you and is, you know, completely non-judgmental, what would they say to you in this situation? You know, if you didn't get that job, for example, what would somebody really cares? And really not just like set, but trying to actually close your eyes and really picture it. So yeah, there's a few exercises there, and there's also a workbook from an Australian group which has some kind of helpful exercises around self-compassion. Something I found really helpful in therapy was this idea which comes from a slightly different therapy called acceptance and commitment, just about values, which is like thinking about what really matters to me and what's important to me, rather than goals. And it's a nice antidote to those kind of very high goal focused. So for me, kind of focusing on what matters to me and why I do my job, not the goals I need to reach, is quite a nice antidote to those relentlessly high standards and the kind of self-criticism that comes with it. Cara, I'm not sure if you've got any thoughts or tips.
Yeah, so I, a while back, I did a course of integrative therapy, which is like a combination of like DBT, CBT and ACT. And we did a lot of like values-based work there. And something that I found really helpful is not only just like kind of identifying what my values were, but kind of noticing like whether they're compatible with me being as like driven and perfectionistic as I tend to be. And actually, am I not kind of aligning with my values by living in that way? And that was really helpful for me to see that actually, even though sometimes it feels like being a sort of like high achieving and perfectionistic type of person is getting me to where I want to be, maybe it is actually blocking me kind of living alongside like some of the values that are important to me.
I think it's about thinking about the pros and cons of it, certainly having these high standards. And I think there's certainly for perfectionism, high standards, about thinking about the middle ground here and some kind of balance. You don't have to get things perfectly all the time. And you know, we're not saying have no goals here. We're not saying have no ambition. It's just, you know, being balanced, giving yourself permission to pause and rest. And I think the really key thing is, if you've got those high standards, just being, trying to be kind to yourself when things don't go right, because they won't, you know. And not comparing yourself to the past. You know, I think Kari spoke a bit about this before, but, you know, when you're picking up the, you know, the pieces from, you know, a relapse, it's not helpful to think about, oh, you know, 10 years ago I was up here and now I'm functioning here, because that's just not fair on yourself, or comparing yourself to other people. That's, again, that's not fair, people who aren't living with bipolar. So I think
it's really interesting what you say there as well about, like, it's not about not setting yourself goals, because I think people are, you know, who have this kind of, you know, personality are inherently like goal driven people, and you don't want to take that away from them, but it's about reframing what kind of goals you're setting yourself. So for me, I used to set myself a lot of goals around things like promotions and like certificates and qualifications and things like that, and I've kind of reframed that into thinking, actually, maybe my goals are more about like experiences and my relationships with people and things like that. So they're not necessarily things that I can attach something like a number to, but more things that are just about goals focused around like my well-being and my happiness, and that's relieved like a lot of pressure that I used to put on myself.
Yeah, thank you. And I think why you're doing it as well, like, I'm doing this because it matters to me, not, you know, to please other people or to show I'm good enough, or Emma, sorry.
No, that's fine. It's a really rich discussion. And once again, I'm reminded of how difficult it is to fit all of these helpful and practical strategies into the hour that we have. I think Cara and Tom, you've done a fantastic job of talking about why people living with bipolar disorder might struggle with these kinds of beliefs, and just how important it is to be aware of that, to give yourself the breathing room to try out some of these new self-compassionate practices. And, you know, I think that the point that you have both brought up at the end there is really important to emphasize, that being self-compassionate doesn't mean giving up your goals or giving up the things that you want to achieve. It just hopefully means that you go about doing those in a way that's a little bit more balanced and self-protective, and makes sure that also you're thinking more broadly those values and how achievement relates to that. I think that's a really important reminder. We have had so many questions come in, and we are going to try to do our best to get through a range of those, tapping into different common threads that people are bringing up. So given there are so many, we'll get started right away, but we will be self-compassionate with ourselves if we do not get through all of them and find another way to hopefully deal with some of those unanswered questions. The first question that we have is, my perfectionism has gotten me a lot of things in my life. It has also led to me being overly hard on myself and self-deprecating. How can I achieve a healthy level of perfectionism so I can get things done but not put myself down in the process?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I'm striving for that right level of perfectionism where I can, I can still have work-life balance. So I think this is where the self-compassion comes in. You know, there was kind of one study that showed that actually having high levels of self-compassion sort of buffers and protects you from those kind of high standards and perfectionism. And just to me as a therapist, I know that being kind to yourself when stuff goes wrong and you do make mistakes is really important. That's going to be kind of really protective. So, and this is something you can cultivate, you know, using those kind of mindfulness exercises that are on the resources to try and practice being more compassionate. Kind of, you know, 5-minute meditations can help with that. So I think that's part of it. And I think it's also just thinking about the pros and cons and balance. I think that's just it's the whole thing with living with bipolar, isn't it? But trying to have somewhere in the middle, you know, I think because high standards and perfectionists, we tend to see the world maybe a bit all or nothing, black and white, but actually trying to kind of be somewhere in the middle. I can be a high achiever and I can still give myself my weekends off. You know, trying to have some kind of middle ground.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think yeah, balance is just a really good way to describe it. I think something that has been really unhelpful for me in the past is kind of setting myself too many goals at once, and then feeling like I'm spreading myself too thinly, and then if things don't go well because I'm spreading myself so thinly, then it kind of feels like the world's ended. So something that has been really like beneficial for me is making sure that I'm not kind of focusing my attention on too many things at once, and that I feel like it's better to do one thing well than to kind of burn myself out trying to do lots and lots of different things. Like, it's taken me many years, but I am now quite good at saying no when things come up that people are asking of me. And that was really hard to do because I had this idea that there was really high expectations of me from other people as well as the ones I had on myself, and I was really worried that I'll be letting people down, or they won't value me anymore, or they won't ask me again, and I'll have lost out on all these potential opportunities. And actually it's been really freeing to just be able to say actually no, and not have to give an excuse for that, just to say actually no, I don't have the capacity to do that right now, or I'm not in a position to do that right now, rather than having to feel like you need to make up something to try and justify it. So saying no has been like a really big thing for me in terms of just being a bit kinder to myself.
I've done exactly the same work and a bit of a purge of projects which I can't really commit to. So yeah, I think beware of that fear of missing out. Yeah, definitely. I think just one other thing I'd say about the kind of high standards and goal-focused behavior, I think a really important rule of thumb is how impulsive it is, because you know it's fine to have really big ideas longer term, but if you're like, I need to do it now, I need to start writing that book now, that's what could escalate into mania. So again, you know, have a list of ideas and put them on the back burner.
Thank you both for your suggestions to that question. I think the really important thread there is that being quite deliberative about the timing and amount of projects that you take on can be really important, both to ward off burnout and potentially mania. And also that, Tom, like you said, being aware of times when, you know, you might be attaching personal meaning to the achievement of these goals, perhaps creating some more healthy space there. Our next question asks, from what I understand, having bipolar disorder comes with having a heightened rejection and reward system. I think this is why failure hurts so much. Is there a way to train this part of our brains in a healthy way?
That's a good question. I think that there is kind of, I think, some evidence about, that people with bipolar tend to be quite, hypersensitive to reward, and quite hypersensitive to failure as well. So I think a lot of the stuff we've talked about being a little bit kinder to self when things do happen can buffer against when bad things happen, you know, being kind to yourself. I think in terms of the kind of reward sensitivity, I don't know, but I think that relates to what we've said about not setting sort of too many goals. And I think that's part of sort of staying well is, you know, making sure you're not doing, you know, too much that can, you know, like going out lots or drinking lots or whatever it is that can make you become unmanic. So I think that's part of it, is trying to kind of rebalance so you don't get that boom and bust. So keeping kind of a balance level of activities and things you enjoy and things that you have to do is an important part of that.
Yeah, I think another part of it is just kind of learning to do things wrong and that nothing bad is going to happen as a result. So you can do things yourself to kind of practice that. So just doing small things like sending emails with like intentional spelling mistakes in them, and little experiments for yourself like that, where you're doing things wrong intentionally, that it's uncomfortable, but there's no negative consequence from it. And just kind of sitting with that feeling of like, actually, I didn't do that perfectly, but it's okay. And the more you can kind of build up evidence that you can cope with that, I think the less difficult it is when things don't go quite to plan unintentionally, when things like that just do kind of come up in life.
Facing your fears, you know, because you have these catastrophic cognitions that things can go really bad if I make a mistake, and actually usually it's nowhere near as bad as you think. And actually what you're saying there, Cara, reminds me of doing some therapy with someone with bipolar, where we had a mistake hierarchy. I mean, we called it something a little bit more rude than that. I won't say the word. of various mistakes you had to make, move, you know, ranging from, you know, not too bad to quite big. But I had to do them as well to try and help along the journey. So I remember calling my colleague the wrong name by intentionally as part of that. And again, it was a bit awkward, but they found it quite funny.
That's a really interesting way to practice out being self-compassionate in perhaps more low-stakes situations rather than trying out self-compassion for the first time when something major happens. Like Cara and Thomas said, making a typo in an email, just learning to train that, you know, train your self-compassionate side is important.
Yeah, burn the toast, start from there. Burn the toast and shrug it off. Start there.
We have had a couple of questions come in, particularly around being self-compassionate to yourself in the aftermath of mania. Self-compassion is very hard to practice when in recovery from a manic episode where we've behaved very much outside of our values. Even though we know it's partially our illness, we still have to be responsible for managing the consequences. How do you manage to have self-compassion when you can't trust yourself?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's that dilemma that sometimes when we need to be most kind to ourselves, it's when it's hardest. When it's hardest to be. You know, both are true. When I need to be kind to myself, it's hardest to. Yeah, I think it's it. Yeah, this isn't to say, you know, being kind to yourself isn't saying, being compassionate to yourself isn't saying, I did nothing wrong. That's not what it's about. And it's not saying like, you know, it actually self-compassion has been used with, you know, for example, people who are offenders, people who have actually committed crimes. And, you know, you can, part of that learning from maybe mistakes and what I can do differently, you know, what I can do to maybe stop this happening, is being kind to yourself, and that's going to help with that process actually. And if there are amends that need to be made, you know, apologies that need to be made, it's going to be a lot easier to do that if you actually need to be kind to yourself. Because if you're not, you're going to be ashamed and hide away, right? You know, if there are bridges you need to repair after a manic episode, it's okay to be kind to yourself. It doesn't mean you're saying everything was okay. It's saying, you know, yeah, I was ill, I made some mistakes. You can still be kind to yourself. Just like the people who really understand, the people who really understand you will hopefully see it that way as well. Cara, go on.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that this is something that I find really difficult as well. I find it much harder to be nice to myself after a manic episode than after a depressive one, because I don't tend to do things that are massively out of character, you know, other than sit around in bed all day and not really socialise and things like that. Whereas, you know, when I'm manic, I do things that are more out of character and things that don't sit very comfortably with me sometimes. Something I did a while back is wrote like a letter to myself as something that what I would like to say to myself after having a manic episode, and then read that back to myself after that's happened. Because I'm, you know, when I am well, I'm able to be more sort of forgiving of myself, I suppose, when I'm reflecting on that, than I am in sort of the immediate aftermath of it. And that's quite helpful to kind of look back and be like, actually, you know, there was a point in my life where I didn't think that this was my fault, even though I feel that way now. And because it's kind of written in like your own words and it's you that's saying it to yourself, it kind of makes it feel like a bit more real, I think, than maybe if other people are saying it to you.
Really good idea. Wise words when you're feeling okay that you can say to yourself. Mm. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that sounds like a really powerful exercise to try out, Cara. So thank you for that suggestion. We've had a couple of comments about how it can be difficult to be self-compassionate when we're in the middle of a society or a workplace that really encourages and pushes for overachievement. So has anyone found talking to their employers helpful around overworking? What has helped? Any practical tips? So, you know, how can you advocate for that more self-compassionate practice when you're in the context which pushes the opposite?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Actually, one of the resources I put in there was a TEDx talk I did last year, which is specifically around achievement and bipolar disorder and the role that society and people can play in that. You know, the messages we get that, you know, if we just work hard enough, we can achieve anything and become millionaires, which, you know, A, isn't true and B, isn't helpful. So, yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that context it comes with. And it's a difficult conversation to have with employers. I've certainly had that conversation, but I appreciate I'm privileged working with people in the mental health field who, you know, have a different view on bipolar disorder. But I think it's important to for people to realize that work works both ways, that yes, I might be really productive when I'm manic, but actually overworking is a really big trigger for me. So, you know, if you see me at my desk late at night, please tell me to go home.
I guess I'm in a similar position to you, and I'm relatively privileged in the field that I work in being able to have those conversations with people. But I've always been like really well supported by my managers when I've spoken about it with them. And I think because I am quite practiced at saying no to things now, like sometimes, I don't know, like in my most recent appraisal, it was a thing of sort of like, what are you going to do next year? And I'd only just finished uni that, you know, last year. And I was just like, actually nothing. Like, I just want to do my job for a little bit. I don't want to go back to uni yet. I don't want to go and get another qualification. I don't want to do any more assignments. Like, and actually I just want to focus on myself right now. And you shouldn't have to be constantly being like pushed to do whatever the next thing is. Actually, if you're settled in your job and that's what you want to be achieving, and there's more important things going on in your life than your job, for which there is for many people, I think it's actually okay to just say I'm perfectly happy as I am at the moment. And if you're kind of, you know, you're doing your job and there's no complaints, then I don't think you always need to be kind of pushing yourself to do whatever the next best thing is, or the next promotion or whatever like that.
Yeah, if you're happy where you are, that's a really good place to be for all of us, really, isn't it? You know, stop and smell the roses, or whatever the expression is.
Thank you both for that advice. I really do appreciate you both acknowledging that, you know, this might be easier or more difficult for people depending on the level of support that they have in their workplace. And we do have a previous Talk BD episode on managing disclosure in the workplace, which you might want to look at if you're trying to evaluate whether or not it's going to be potentially helpful to have these conversations. And so we will be talking about where you can access that in the chat. Our next question: I find it very difficult to tease apart the negative self-beliefs that stem from trauma and those that come from episodes of bipolar disorder. I imagine many people with bipolar disorder have trauma. It's like a double load of twisted beliefs. Do you think that treating the trauma helps? And is it common in bipolar disorder therapy? I'm doing EMDR and it's been very helpful.
That's really good to hear that EMDR is helpful. I've had EMDR as a patient with bipolar disorder, and for me it was life changing. It was really amazing, and it wasn't PTSD per se, but it was working on some difficult events when I was younger that very much fueled my high standards and my self-critical tendencies. So yeah, I think that's really important, and I'm sort of trying to write a book chapter and do a bit of research about that at the moment. PTSD is common. I don't know if there's a Talk BD on that, but I think by some estimates maybe a quarter of people, but like I said, it's, you know, childhood abuse is much more common, unfortunately. Where the beliefs start, you said that, the start of the question was, where does the trauma beliefs start and related to the mania? I think they're often two parts of the same coin, and I think perhaps that the mood episodes and what happens and other people's responses can, maybe I can use the word re-traumatized here, you know, because if you have deep beliefs from the past that you're not good enough and people don't appreciate you, and then, you know, that can get reinforced maybe by what happens when you're unwell. Yeah, so I don't see them as separate, unfortunately. What happens living with bipolar can bring up difficult stuff from the past.
And I think it sometimes doesn't matter which which part the cognition comes from, as long as you can do something about it. So you could spend a lot of time trying to work out, like, actually, is this my bipolar disorder or is this trauma? But it's actually, it's whether you can do something about it that's kind of the important thing, rather than trying to spend a lot of time working out exactly where it comes from. And you can absolutely target both of those things in therapy. So I think it's fine for that to be brought up in a therapeutic space, regardless of which kind of one of those things that you're there as sort of like being as the primary thing that you're being treated for.
Yeah, there is some evidence for EMDR in bipolar disorder. And I think that there's one group which are currently looking at if it can actually not just reduce PTSD symptoms, but also prevent relapse of bipolar as well. I don't think there's anything about kind of trauma-focused CBT in bipolar specifically, but I've certainly used it as a therapist. And, you know, following what Cara said before, I think I've had some people before say, oh, so you're saying I've got, PTSD and bipolar, and I wouldn't see them as two separate things as a psychologist. Mm. It's trauma-related bipolar disorder, Trauma is an established risk factor for bipolar.
It will be really interesting to see where the research goes in teasing apart how we can deal with different types of negative self-beliefs and build up compassion when people have had these difficult experiences.
Yeah, and I'm trying to do some research on that at the moment, actually, whether those high standards and self-compassion are different in bipolar depending on the difficult experiences you might have. So perhaps QuestBD can share that if anyone's willing to take part.
Yeah, please do keep us updated. We have had a couple of questions come in about how you can build self-compassion when you have a specific type of dysfunctional belief where you discount the positive. Both of you being CBT therapists would be familiar with this one. So how can you build self-compassion when you have a big tendency to reject positive feedback from others?
Kawa, do you want to start? I don't know if you've got any thoughts.
The way that I personally do this and like recommend to other people that they could do this is starting to write things down. Not just things that other people have said to you, but also things that you notice that you're achieving, and they can be really small things. So I don't know, if you're struggling with with like low mood, it can just be things like getting out of bed, brushing your teeth, stuff like that. It doesn't have to be really significant big achievements like a qualification or a promotion or anything like that. It can be small things that you've done over the course of the day or the week. And also doing things like writing down like nice things that other people have said about you and kind of theming them together, because for me that's quite good evidence that actually if a few people have said this thing about me, why would they all not be truthful about that? And actually, what do other people have to gain from not being truthful about that? And when you kind of think about actually what would the rationale be for somebody saying positive things about me and them not being truthful, it can be really hard to try and find evidence for that. So I think a lot of it is about, for me, I write a lot of stuff down, and that really helps me to kind of pick apart kind of when my brain feels a bit messy. And I advocate for that a lot. Like I'm always setting people homework of like lists that they need to write down and evidence tables and things like that to try and sort of pick apart those thoughts and put them down on paper a little bit, because they can feel really messy when they're sort of going around in your head rather than when you can actually put them down and look at them and start focusing on them as like individual things.
Yeah, I've got we're all very good at focusing on the negative. I'm trying to put a link in the chat about a picture I've got about how your brains can just focus on the negative. I've actually got it up on my wall in my office at the university. Yeah, I agree, trying to note these things, because sieve and a sponge, our brain can be like a sieve and a sponge, and the compliments go in the sieve and the bad stuff goes in the sponge. So that's really important to sort of remind yourself about that. And Cara said before about if you don't like making mistakes, practice making mistakes. Practice sitting there with compliments. Get someone to maybe just sit there. I've certainly done that in therapy with people who don't like taking compliments. I really like your shoes. You did really well today, and just sit there and just let them sit with it. So yeah, trying to practice that. I appreciate it's hard. But keep it in your sponge.
Thank you. We are running close to time, so I think what I'll ask our hosts to do now, like we've talked about how building self-compassion is a process. It's like growing a plant, and we've talked about a couple of different strategies and meditation practices that you might try. If there was one small step that you could recommend to our viewers today to get started on the road to building more self-compassion, what would it be?
I think one question to ask yourself every day is, what would I say to someone else whenever you notice you're being hard on yourself? And I really would suggest some of those kind of exercises. There's lots more on YouTube, but we've put some on the link in the resources about some exercises to try and be kinder to yourself are really important, because actually at some level you need to go deeper than kind of, you know, talking about it. You need to do, so they're much more emotional. They kind of get in at a deeper level. So I think really trying to do some of those is really important.
I think as like a small sort of place to start, I would say I had this as therapy homework a few years ago, and I found it really helpful in terms of a starting place, is just to make sure that at least one evening a week, you're just spending that evening doing something that you want to do just because it makes you happy and because it makes you feel good, not because you're getting anything out of it other than that, or because it's making other people happy, or there's any sort of achievement involved in it at all, but just because it's something that just feels nice and it boosts your mood, and it's just something that's like, you know, you being kind to yourself. And even if you're, you know, really busy all the rest of the time and you're working really hard and you're doing lots of different things, even just spending like one evening a week just on you can be really good for your self-esteem.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much for your insightful advice and really helpful encouragement to people who might be trying to implement these skills for the first time. I think it was really, really helpful to hear you unpack where those perfectionistic beliefs might be coming from, because it's not just necessarily tied to symptoms of bipolar disorder, but it's, I think, been really interesting to hear how that might be embedded and influenced in our societal context and the messages that we receive from other people and the media. So I think recognizing that helps give people the first little bit of breathing room to then try practicing some of these strategies. And you've given so many useful resources and tips. So we will be, of course, putting those up on our Talk BD webpage to share with attendees. So thank you once again for the sharing. I think at this point in time, we'll move into our resources and toolkits. So Cara and Tom have mentioned quite a few websites and practical resources that might be helpful to go through. So we have, of course, some tests of self-compassion. Dr. Christian Neff has a lot of resources available on their website, including meditation tracks and exercises, and the Centre for Clinical Interventions in Australia also has a self-guided workbook that you may find useful. We also have our own Chris Beattie Bipolar Wellness Centre webpage, which talks about self-esteem and how that differs from self-compassion and why it's important to your quality of life. So we have some more resources there. We'd also like to recommend Tom's TEDx talk, which talks about the lure of mania and that influence of achievement striving for people with bipolar disorder. And also Cara's Gora, which is her mental health blog, where she talks a lot more in depth about some of the issues that we've talked about today. We'd also like to flag her forthcoming book, which is an interactive journal that draws on creative exercises to help you stay well. So if you joined us for the Creativity Talk BD, you'll know how important that can be to wellness in bipolar disorder. So that is coming out shortly. Our Talk BD website is where you can go to view past episodes. You can search by topic, by speaker, and keep up to date with other blogs or resources produced by our guest experts. And once again, any resources that the panel shared will be linked there. You can also listen to previous episodes of Talk BD on Spotify or your preferred podcast player, and the videos will be available on YouTube for you to review. After you exit the Zoom webinar, a little questionnaire will come up asking you for your thoughts on today's session. Please do share your feedback with us and your thoughts on topics that we might do in future TalkBD events, as it helps us decide what to focus on. We also have our CrestBD academic website where you can stay up to date with new research studies that we're doing. The Crest Currents newsletter is a great place to hear about forthcoming events and studies, including our next TalkBD event. So if you'd like to know when that will be running and what topic that's on, please do consider following us on social media or a newsletter. We'd also like to thank our funders and partners who are integral in supporting this work. And so thank you again to everyone who attended, who shared questions and tips in the chat, and particularly to our guests, Tom and Cara, for sharing your really warm and encouraging insights and advice. So until next time, everyone, please do stay healthy and we'll see you next time.